Jan Hansen and I have not collaborated, exchanged notes, connived, or planned this hour together. But we hope that since we're talking about the dialectic with a capital D, that we might have a little dialectic between ourselves as we talk about this both from an economic and a theological standpoint. I noticed that Jan Hansen picks the day he's leaving to deal with the hot issues of all, and you're going to leave me here to...
I wanted to set you up for the rest of the week.
Thanks, Jan. I really appreciate that very much. But actually, we did agree that although this topic is not dealt with too much in the churches, unfortunately, that it must be the church, which is the freest institution of society. It should be a place, a forum, an arena for discussing anything and everything. Somehow it is. I don't know how your experience is, Jen, that... It seems the church is sometimes the last place where the very difficult, sometimes delicate issues become discussed. It shouldn't be that way. In the freedom of the gospel, where you have the sense of God being in charge of history and your life, a sense of God holding you for all eternity, there should be the great liberating power to now enter into the world, enter into discussion, dialogue, and action, without any fear of people or institutions or whatever, and especially free to discuss those things which present the greatest challenge to the church and the world in our day. One of them is certainly Marxism and the various forms of Marxism and communism that are, really taking over in great waves in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and in other places, Eastern Europe, and very close to home. So at our own peril, we ignore this issue, and if we do ignore it, we betray one basic tenet of the Christian faith, namely the freedom of the gospel wherein Christ hath set us free. I should say, to begin with, a particular bias that I have, and I think Jan Hansen shares it. I was reading, the Communist Manifesto last night after, it was about 8 o'clock or 9, was it, after the play, and I was listening to the Christmas caroling. I was just like, around. And here you're reading this call to revolution and the destruction of the bourgeois capitalist system, and all these Christmas music filtering in through the window. And finally, I just took the book, and I was right at my place, and I said, that's it, enough, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And I hope that that doesn't betray a sense of openness to what is being spoken to us in the words of this book. It just betrays the fact that when your basic commitment is caught up in the great anthems of Christmas, your sort of existential gut reaction takes over, and your primary commitment begins to outweigh all secondary commitments, and I went out and sang a few songs. Well, both of us agree that with respect to Marxism itself, maybe with respect to Christianity too, a great deal of ignorance abounds. And we are here to demonstrate the truth of that utterance in this next...
because I was thinking as you said that, as you earlier talked about, I had a religion course at St. Olaf, and I think I can remember one statement from that, and that was from a guy by the name of Ditmansen, and talking about the church, he said, and this is the only statement I can remember, the church is dragged kicking and screaming into every sociological decade. So I do, I guess I do agree with you that the church, not every church, but in general, the church is sort of very definitely behind the times. Can I say something about the Communist Manifesto now and Karl Marx? I don't know how many of you have read the manifesto, but it opens with kind of a very foreboding statement. It says, a specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism, and all the powers of old Europe have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise the specter. Then he goes on to talk about the Pope and the Tsar, about the Metternichs, about the French radicals, and about the German police spies attempting to exorcise this communist specter. And the year is 1848. And there's really sort of a tremendous terror in the old order in Europe regarding what is to be expected. There are uprisings everywhere, in Germany, in France, in Belgium, in England. The German poet Heinrich Heine toured the factories in France at about this time, and he said, it's really frightful to listen to the French workmen as they are working, sort of swinging their sledgehammers, singing radical songs which have a kind of a demonic spirit to them. And he said, it's no wonder that we are sort of expecting a revolution. But I keep thinking that the revolution that's going to occur, or at least that the leaders and the writers of the Communist Manifesto expected, the revolution of communism with the workers, is not so much a revolution of communism, a revolution of a group of people taking over and putting people into bondage, which we're so often... which we so often believe, but rather it's a revolution against the working conditions which existed in Europe at the time. And I don't know how many of you can remember from your reading or remember from seeing maybe the movie Oliver, you know, what conditions were like in Europe. Well, those conditions describe, you know, somewhat accurately England. And England was really kind of a peaceful, idyllic, quiet place in comparison with what the rest of Europe was like. In Germany, for instance, there was no parliament. Now, this is 1840 now. There was no parliament. There was no freedom of speech. There was no trial by jury. There was no toleration of any idea which deviated very far from the idea that the monarchy was still divine. in Russia, was it de Tocqueville who said that Russia was the cornerstone de Tocqueville said about Russia? Despotism. Those are the words of de Tocqueville. So I think we have to kind of get that perspective, that the revolution is not one of putting people sort of into bondage. It's really a revolution to sort of overthrow the working conditions that existed.
It was sort of like Mark Hansen's devotions this morning at the second setting, I guess. You know, that's where you understand the roots of this movement, when a poor 7-year-old is forced to do dishes and his parents call him and say, now's the time, and giving him an apron and so forth and say, you know, didn't your heartstrings really move when you told this story this morning? But, Jan, now Engels also wrote this book, The Condition of the Working Class in England. And that was a very vivid description of what was going on in the day. You're saying that we have to understand the manifesto and the movement over against this disenfranchisement of these workers. I guess you'd say by the Industrial Revolution that was going on. What were some of the conditions, though?
The working day was 14 to 16 hours for adults, 10 to 12 hours for children. We're familiar with such things as sweatshops. The fact that you worried about having enough to eat so that you could sort of drag yourself to work the next day. The fact that you knew that if you faltered one day and couldn't get to work, there was sort of an army of unemployed people that would immediately take your slot. And your wage was just barely a subsistence wage. If you did not work for 1 or 2 days, and if somebody else in the family then didn't contribute to your upkeep, you were probably finished. You know, it was that close to existence or subsistence that the people lived by.
Maybe I could just, okay, let's say that these were the conditions, which we might already be thinking ahead to what the big allure of Marxism is throughout the world if we realize this fact. Let's just make a switch now to the religion of that day, because that also might give us some insight into the nature of Marx's response to religion today. I don't want to get too far ahead, but let's say corresponding to this alienation of people during the Industrial Revolution, what type of a church was it? Well, it was mainly the Church of East Prussia that controlled much of Europe, and even churches in France and England could fit into the mold of a rather aristocratic, authoritarian church. The bishop and the head of state were like this. There was no critique over against the excesses of the Industrial Revolution, and no really major attempt to seek justice for the workers. There were attempts like the intermission experiment in Europe that began to sort of pick up the pieces, more social welfare, that the people who were thrown out of work might get a bowl of soup. But there was no attempt to deal with the root causes of social, economic, and political injustice in the world today. If you wanted a building permit, you had to even go to the bishop to get that. There was no real sharp dividing line between the church and the state. The bishop blessed the armies as they went off to war and generally put their stamp of approval on the status quo. And of course, you were nurtured by this great, especially in Germany, by this great move of German idealism, especially the philosopher Hegel, who looked at history as the unfolding of the Holy Spirit's movement to bring about, essentially, the predominance of the Prussian state, this movement through freedom, this dialectical movement that Marx finally picked up and, as he said, turned Hegel on his head, was really showing how the absolute spirit was manifesting itself in fulfillment in the Prussian state. So, going along with the description of the working conditions, one must also see this type of a situation in the aristocratic church, which becomes then the focal point for Marx's critique.
Marx did say religion is the opium of the people, which was...
Yeah, I tell you, why don't you, let's find out before we jump.
Okay.
Now, granted, let's just put this in perspective. We're in the middle of the 19th century now, and today we see that there are waves of Marxist variations on Marx throughout the world, and it is spreading, Asia, Africa, Latin America. We also have the phenomenon that there are many Christians who call themselves Marxists. Look at Helmut Gollwitzer in Berlin. He's written a treatise a couple months ago called Ich bin Kommunist, I am a communist. He is, of course, a very evangelical Lutheran pastor. Is this possible? Now, okay, let's ask, first of all, what are the elements, the basic fundamental elements of Marxist theory? And then let's go on to say, secondly, are there any elements in common with Christianity? Thirdly, are there elements in disagreement? And then let's ask what the challenge is for today, if we get that far, which we hopefully do. Now let's just talk about I think the idea of religion as the opiate of the people comes out of the theory of dialectical materialism. So why don't you start, and we'll throw this back and forth. And if anybody wants to interrupt and say, hold it, stop, or interject a comment, please feel free to do so.
Okay, so you want me? Okay, on dialectical materialism, it turns out that dialectical is simply a means of thinking or a process of argumentation. That's really what we mean by dialectical, sort of a changing of events. But any dialectical process sort of begins with a contradiction, okay? And the contradiction contains tension. And that tension sort of compels a resolution. But as the resolution arises, you see, it creates another tension which compels another resolution. And so it's sort of an ongoing process. We describe it sort of as the thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis.
Let's just take an example. Now, what if I said, I think it's good that we celebrate Christmas in July? And we say, we call that the thesis. You're next.
That's what I was afraid you were going to say. Okay, and what would the antithesis be then?
Well, you probably don't.
I don't think it's good to celebrate it in July. I think it really ought to be celebrated in December.
Mm-hmm. But now when we think about it, maybe allowing us, if we are free to celebrate it in July, then we can throw off some of all the trappings of, you know, buying presents and everything, running around. We never really get the meaning of Christmas. Couldn't we, do you think? Is there any chance that
there could be a resolution coming out of this where we could agree on some form of Christmas that didn't take place either in July or December? Or maybe it could take place either in July or December. But no, but it didn't have all of this.
I just want a simple example.
I think in deep circles. How about a simplistic Christmas in November?
Okay. We got a November Christmas. Okay, then from the yes comes a no, comes a, let's say, just a resolution. But then this resolution then, what did you say we're going to have it? In November.
Yeah.
Okay, but now the November Christmas. Now I think that November Christmases are very bad because you're just preparing for Christmas then.
I was thinking you were going to say something about conflicting with Thanksgiving.
Oh yeah, that's right.
But you see, we could incorporate Christmas and Thanksgiving as part of the as part of the synthesis.
So that this resolution then becomes a new
thesis.
It becomes a new thesis then. So we're going to start this process all over again. And this is, you recall, this is the contradiction, right?
Right.
Okay. And now let's put this in Marxist terms. If we said that the thesis, although there are little contradictions in the movement, would we say that feudalism the opposite of feudalism is
capitalism.
Is okay. Well,
maybe it's communism.
No, but what if we say that the opposite of feudalism? I think the contradiction to feudalism would be the rise of property and so forth.
Okay, all right.
And or merchants and free enterprise, mm-hmm. free enterprise, and private property. Okay, and then. And that is somehow resolved in capitalism. And then that capitalism then becomes the new thesis. So we can put that over here again. And then it is contradicted by
workers?
Worker power?
Worker power.
Mm-hmm.
That would be good.
What else, anybody? Collectivism.
So that now the contradiction becomes one of class struggle?
Yeah. I mean, there are little contradictions inside, too, with respect to the two classes that Marx talked about, namely the proletariat and the bourgeois. And this would, of course, become socialism. And that socialism, then, becomes a new thesis. And it is then contradicted. And the final result, the final synthesis, where everything sort of ends, at least for Marx, I don't think for Mao. Mao keeps going on, the dialectic. But for Marx, it ends with what?
Anybody? Communism, the classical state.
Communism. So we don't have any communism yet. This is the classless society. And actually, he builds on the Socratic dialogue. Socrates went around asking people in Athens, you know, what is justice? And Thrasymachus would say, justice is the interest of the stronger. And then Socrates would go back, but can we say that it's equivalent to being to the interest of the stronger? Are there some things that are not in the interest of the stronger yet are still justice? And it would go back and forth like this in the Socratic dialogues. And I think this is what Hegel picked up. And Hegel developed the theory, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, in the realm of what he called idealism. And then Marx comes along and with his major critique of Hegel, and he says, I'm putting Hegel on his head, where he is up in the clouds in idealism. Now we're going to deal with materialism. You know, could I just add a thing, if I could erase this for a minute? And you can say if this is right or wrong. I think there were three stages for Marx. One was stage one, was sort of prehistory. And this was a sort of Adam and Eve type ideal primitive state. And then stage two, which is the stage of what do you call it? Let's see. I think the stage three is the history.
History of man or something.
Yeah, got it. Oh no, I think it's called. This is called prehistory. Here we are in prehistory now, And this first one is called the original state. That's the state of original communism, he calls it. Original communism is state one. That's when everything is perfect and man lives in harmony with nature. It's the sort of Garden of Eden state. Then stage two comes when history starts and man becomes conscious of creation of tools. And here we have all of what we have just said and just erased. We are in prehistory now, this age of alienation and contradiction. And then stage three will be the state of history proper, which is the classless society. And I think he says between stage two and three, this borderline here, is where the revolution takes place. And those people who are most free, who are conscious that this revolution is going to take place between prehistory and history. This is the revolution that's going on at the present time. And those people who live on the borderline sense that they are on the side of history. And this is deterministic. That is to say, you can do nothing to stop the course. If you rise up to oppose it, it will just roll over you like a steamroller. And freedom, in that sense, is not having your own choice, and there's no ability to oppose it so that it will veer off course, but it will just move inexorably to its final culmination in the class, the society. It's totally deterministic system, according to Marx.
Yeah. This is what Marx is saying, right?
This is what Marx is saying.
His,
right. This is Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. They're the ones that espouse the deterministic theory of history.
And the whole notion of alienation comes about as a result of the forces of production on the one hand, and sort of the method of production on the other hand, which then ultimately leads to the fact that the forces of production become then the capitalist society, and the method of production become the alienated workers. And out of that, comes that synthesis.
Yeah.
So
okay. Well,
that's where materialism enters into this whole scheme, is in that whole process of production.
Okay, let's then talk about the stage two. Just talk about the stage two. Then he says it's the means of production, so it's the economic factor that determines everything. Economic factor. That is to say, whether the economic factor is, say, socialist, that determines everything else that in the society. If you have a socialist economic factor, which is the guiding principle of history, then you're going to have art that is socialist. Then you're going to have music, not so like art, socialist. You're going to have politics that's socialist. You're going to have education that's socialist. And it's the economic factor that determines. These are only, Marx called this factor here, the substructure. We're talking just about the stage two. This is the substructure, and this is the superstructure. And the superstructure is really insignificant in Marx. What only counts is the substructure, because these are all functions of this. That is, if you have a capitalistic economic factor, then education is going to be capitalistic. Religion is going to be capitalistic. Art is going to be capitalistic. Politics is going to be capitalistic. And I think at that point that this arrow only goes in one direction. That is, you cannot get a political factor that would be reversed and influence the economic factor. You could not get something in education that would then influence the economic factor. The economic factor is built into the deterministic laws of history, and there's no variation whatsoever. It means that religion, if we can get to that, should I just make the slight discursus there? It means that religion cannot influence anything. Religion does not influence anything. It also means that the view of man, by the way, is socialist. Man. So there can be no constant understanding of human nature in Marxism, because it's the economic factor that influences at every single point, and no other factor. And so that the view of man will be socialistic. Here it will be capitalistic. Under feudalism, it will be feudalistic. And the arrow only goes in one direction. But now, with respect to religion, which concerns us now, that the substructure of capitalism produces capitalistic religion, which is to say, a religion of the bourgeois class, a religion that is only, as Marx says, a function of the capitalist system. This is why in Eastern Europe today and in other places they say, well, if you pull out the capitalist rug, religion should just collapse by itself, automatically. It just would because capitalism is rooted in, religion is rooted in capitalism. It doesn't do that, so they have to help it along. But theoretically, it should totally collapse. Marx says religion is the opiate of the people. That is to say, it is just a device on the part of the owners of the means of production to tranquilize the masses so that they do not see their alienation. It's to tell them about another world so that they will take their thoughts off the harsh existence of the conditions in the factories and the conditions in this world. Religion is only there as an opiate, an opium, so that people will be tranquilized from the alienation. Yeah?
And is that the reason why a man like Solzhenitsyn that could go into exile and live in Western society frustrated, knowing that perhaps revolution as a man who was thinking on socialistic, capitalistic lines has no existence in Russia, and why Russia can let a man like that go out without killing him?
Well, the big question in the North West, anybody who lives here, is how they're going to deal with him.
No, would you say a couple more sentences?
What I'm wondering is, Solzhenitsyn, then along this line, comes into our country and tries to give us a window into socialism along a thinking man's line. And I'm wondering, you know, Solzhenitsyn, where he's living now on the East Coast, must be frustrated in trying to speak to us as he does, and we will not listen. We don't even understand his mind. And yet, in some semblance, he wants freedom as a socialist.
You mean because he's in essence standing across the river? He's got a whole different paradigm of thought.
Kind of like Jeremiah.
Whole different think widths, as John says, than we do, and so it's hard to bridge that gap.
Yeah, just like here, it's hard to see, you know, that the superstructure socialistic and the superstructure capitalistic. You know, where does it lead us?
But I guess I don't see, ultimately, I don't see that much difference between the superstructure that socialism creates and the superstructure that capitalism creates. You know, ultimately, they're both societies oriented towards production. Ultimately, they're both societies trying to satisfy and trying to give to the people that which they have produced. And the basic difference is really one uses a more forceful method of distribution, socialism, and the other uses a also forceful in a way, but more implicitly, you know, maybe more covertly forceful system called price. You know, because ultimately, you can only buy in our society in accordance with what you produce. And there are all kinds of institutions, I think, built into our structure which prevent certain people from getting the income, with developing their abilities, you know, and so on. So I guess way in the back of my mind, I kind of think that, you know, we say tremendous things about this price system and how it distributes commodities and so on, but there are so many institutions that we have built into this, such as labor unions, such as welfare, such as government controls, and so on, that we covertly may and maybe not deliberately do about the same thing in our superstructure as socialism does in their superstructure. So I don't know that there's that much difference between the two.
And yet, on the one hand, you know, we say that atheistic communism. And yet, when you analyze capitalism, there's a lot of atheism there, too. Which is, you know, you look at the Communistic Manifesto at Marx, and you know, man is sinner. There's no place for God. And I'm sure you know down there in capitalism, money has replaced it.
Yeah, of course. See, Marx's understanding of religion comes about, you know, it obviously has to reflect the times in which he lived, you know, and there the church was not a, I don't think, a caring church. It wasn't the kind church. It wasn't the forgiving church. It was just about the opposite.
So See, what Jan is saying is that maybe the religion that Marx rejected is the religion we would choose also to reject.
Yeah, but when this country was established, it wasn't established by Christians, it was established by deists. They established a God as a creator. They weren't Christians, but Marxists persecuted the Christianity or as such. He didn't believe in Christianity, but this country wasn't established under a Christian society.
Well, okay, let's keep this in mind now as we continue, that sometimes we talk about religion and assume that everybody's got the same idea about religion. So with that in mind, let's just ask about the religion that Marx rejected. Now, I mean, he said this, religion, he lumped them all into this together with metaphysics, philosophy, and he called it by one word, idealism. This is the Marxist critique against idealism, by which he also included, especially Hegel, all of 19th century philosophy, including the Enlightenment view of progress, human betterment, and this sort of idealistic belief that everything was getting better all the time. This was also just a device. All of these, coming on the basis of the substructure, was idealism, which was a false world. Just a world of illusion. But now, as you say, let's ask the nature of this philosophy. Let's ask the nature of this religion. Well, we've already characterized this religion. In a sense, we have to say Marx was right. Religion was, in fact, in the face of the Industrial Revolution, it's just the easy escape for people. It was the opium. It was this transcendent vertical, and of course the major critique was against Lutheranism. Although Marx came from a long line of Jewish rabbis, his father converted to Lutheranism before he was born. So Marx grew up in a Lutheran church and was confirmed in a Lutheran church. But the reason that his father converted to Christianity was mainly because this is, as he said, the entrance card into the Enlightenment culture. In other words, you could hardly be a Jew in Prussian Germany at that time and have any status if you acknowledged your Jewishness. So he converted, and he became part, really, of the established aristocratic Christian family. And he always sensed what he called the demon in my son, Marx's father, Heinrich Marx. And he said, because his son was always pulling and always just unhappy with the nature of this religion, where everybody had to be religious. You had to fulfill the forms. Religion was taught in the schools and so forth. Now, when he finally rejected ideology, religion is ideology, perhaps he was rejecting something that we have to reject also. Now, that's what you're saying. I think that's your point. And or to put it in terms of the Christian understanding of idolatry, we understand idolatry as if you take the reality of God and encapsulate it into some form, such that this form does not become the channel through which God breaks through, but becomes a sort of deified earthen vessel. The earthen vessel somehow contains the transcendent power, and the transcendent power is not allowed to shatter the vessel. In other words, this is really the identification of God with an object. We call that paganism. Now, maybe it is that if you're an atheist in Marx's sense, that is to say, if you reject this, that is the only condition for considering the reality of Christianity. In other words, maybe to be an atheist is the first step in becoming a believing Christian.
place is Sundance Mountain out in Wyoming.
Yeah.
I'm just a little bit confused, so I want to ask it.
And,
it seems to me, you know, that atheism is somewhat incidental to communism. Correct me if I'm wrong. It doesn't seem like an essential part of communism. Is the fact that atheism is so strongly associated with communism because of Karl Marx himself feeling so strongly against religion? And could communism have possibly evolved without espousing atheism? Or is there something essential to the philosophy of communism that excludes religion?
Some people would argue that we have clouded the issue of communism by throwing in there this notion of atheism. You know, that it is something preconceived by the capitalistic superstructure to prevent us from really looking at what's going on. You know, and we tend to be a kind of a religious community, this capitalistic structure, you know. And there's always been a fear of communism in this country. And one way to cloud the entire issue of communism is to bring in some other issue which has to do with religion and atheism and so on. Now that some people will take that extreme point of view.
I think that that's true, what you say. I think orthodox Marxism, which is what we're talking about here, orthodox Marxism, is they are religion and communism are mutually exclusive. They do not allow for each other, precisely because of the fact that it's the economic condition that determines.
In other words, communism is a religion.
Well, many have called it so. I would say since it is a belief system, since it does have a sort of evangelical fervor, it does have its Bible. It does have its Bible, it does have its prophets, it does have its turning point in history, it does have a beginning in history and an ending in history, a fulfillment in history. You could certainly call it at least a pseudo-religion. I don't know if you called it a religion, whether too many communists would, at least on their terms, be too happy. But I think this is legitimate thinking to see it as such.
Yeah, but what... Okay, Marx said that if you determine the economic factor as communism, religion would die out.
Right.
Okay? He was obviously, well, we don't have true communism. In socialism, he was obviously wrong. In socialistic countries, you know, notably Poland, but also Russia, the religion still plays a very strong part unless it's really clamped down on. Is Marx such a god that... Communist theoreticians can't accept the fact that perhaps communism doesn't exclude religion, and it seems to me like a lot of these countries alienate such a large percentage of their population against communism because they suppress religion. And what I'm wondering, if there's a basic, you know, I'm hard to explain.
No, I think you're right on target. I think you're right on target. But if you read Orthodox Marxists today, they would still maintain that under socialism, that and when we had our discussion about Christianity in East Germany, I read from a recent Russian periodical where the theoretician said that it is disappearing on its own. It's just taken a bit longer than we thought, but that it is disappearing, and these are mutually exclusive, and that we just have to do this, and this to help it along. But I think you're right in your critique, saying that maybe this is the place where Marxist thinking missed the boat, and that the historical development shows that. They would say, no, that they are right. It's just taking longer than we thought. But your question is, does not this arrow really move in the other direction? So that the religious factor actually influences the economic, political, and social life.
Well, that obviously must be what communist countries who suppress suppress religion are worried about, or they wouldn't worry about, they would,
right.
I mean, they must be obviously worried that the religion influences people's thinking about the economic situation.
Yeah. Right, this is, as the Pope's visit to Poland shows, that what you're saying is this arrow probably moves in this direction, so that the influence of factor, the economic factor, is actually realistic.
And he's you're to some extent arguing with the whole dialectical process
as a
way of, that's all right.
I'm not really arguing with the dialectic process. I'm saying that this particular dialectic, maybe Marx was wrong, and that.
Well, see, in Marx said there's only one factor, and that's the economic factor, and all of these other intellectual factors have no influence whatsoever. If any, it's negligible on whatever type of structure exists. Now, are you then saying that maybe there is a religious antithesis developing to fight the economic thesis?
Well, I didn't say that, but that's interesting.
That's what I thought you were. You know, sort of getting, which may be
interesting too.
Well, that has to be the whole center of that, then, doesn't it? If there's something counteracting the economic factor, it's not just religion, but what controls religion is the spirit of God, for which Marx did not allow that to happen, right? So it has to be such that in the theoretical statements that he makes, he is saying there's no God, right?
That's right. But my argument is that the type of God, maybe Marx would not listen to what I'm going to say here, but if you took him on his own basis, if this is the God that Marx is rejecting, this is the God I'm rejecting too. This is not my God. I want nothing to do with this God. If to be an atheist is to reject this God, then I'm an atheist. And that's why I say to be an atheist is the first step in becoming a believing Christian, which is what Ernst Bloch has said. Because I want nothing to do with this God. This God. But, as I say, Marx might not, he might say, I'm talking about all possible gods. So he might not listen. But I'm saying on Marxian basis, maybe the church has to say, yes, this idealistic, utopian, otherworldly, static, petrified God is not the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It's not the God of Jesus Christ. And we agree with Marx. We agree with Marx to this extent that we also reject idealism and the idealistic God, who is not the friend of the alienated workers.
Well, then it seems to me where Marx sort of screwed up was not allowing religion to become a communist religion.
Well, I'm not so sure Marx screwed up there. I think what Marx was really trying to do, was to sort of write about the fall and the extinction of capitalism rather than what the idealistic communistic society would be. I don't think he went beyond saying that there's a classless society in which there will be no private property rights, and that's why history will sort of stop, because we have no private property rights, and so we have nothing to fight and struggle with. And I think he's been interpreted variously by especially Lenin, which is sort of, maybe it's Lenin that screwed up.
Okay, I was going to say, if they really felt like it was just going to die, they could just let it fly, and perhaps a communist religion would have developed that would have been better than a capitalist religion. That still could have been called Christian, Lutheran.
it sure would have been easier to do such funny things as tithe and distribute and evenly in that kind of a system.
See, that's what we have to ask ourselves. To what extent we're tied to the system? I have to go in the back, unless you're going to change the subject. Are you?
No, I was going to say that the Marxist God wasn't the living God, in other words. Right? What Marxist saw was not the living God. He saw in this little capsule, as he saw it in his day. And for that reason, he couldn't see the influence and the arrow going in the other direction.
Yeah. I would agree with you.
I would too.
Excuse me, the scriptures say that the church is God, but not the living God. Wait a second. Let me just take it in order, Paul.
Oh, I thought you were waving.
So it's close together there. Go ahead.
Oh, that's all I was going to say.
No, I was talking to this woman in the red shirt. You were next.
Then it was Paul.
I'm sorry, Paul. It's re-entry time, Paul.
No, to Paul.
I'll erase mine if you erase his.
No.
We can cancel each other out more or less. If we agree to erase our statement.
Okay, make your statement again.
I said, immediately after this gentleman spoke, I haven't turned around yet to see who he is.
Paul.
It might be just as accurate to say that the church's God at that time was not the living God. And to some extent, at this time, is not.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was trying to say.
See, this might be the lasting question that the Marxist critique of religion directs to us that we have to take seriously today. One thing to look at the 19th century, another thing is to say, to what extent are we really a function of C, the capitalist society? To what extent do we think that money raised in this country or from our churches is sort of ours to allocate to the world? To what extent have we linked the church with private property, the profit motive, and the exploitation of third world countries? To what extent is Marxist critique right on target for us today?
In this idea of religion, I think we're all using different ideas, definitions of that word. For some of us, it's a very positive definition. For others of us, it is very negative. And obviously, for Marx, it's negative. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer would agree, for instance, because he hoped that eventually we'd have a non-religious Christianity, as he called it. And whereas Marx saw the center of human reality and understanding the world as economics, Bonhoeffer hoped that eventually we'd see Christ, or that we that people of faith, not people of religion, but people of faith, have Christ as the center. And so if Marx would say that religion is the opiate of the people, I think we would agree. And we would go farther with that, and we would say that faith is the stimulant of the people. And it brings about a lot of the same things that what Marx is hoping for and says will come about in the communist state, which ends up being very holistic. It is no longer divided up into the little political, social, religious spheres. All of life is whole. Mm-hmm. And relationship is the center.
There was another dialectical thinker, you know, that did something, isn't that what Kierkegaard did? I don't really know too much about Kierkegaard. But he would have said this, all economic factor, all of this is lumped together, and that's existence. And that's the contradiction.
Okay. See, now we can... of course, we are operating with two different understandings of religion. One, a negative one, and one, what we think has some value. You're suggesting that, as other people have, Bonhoeffer and Karl Barth, have suggested that we dump religion altogether. And that might be a good idea. Maybe it's a word that we cannot use anymore. Actually, Jesus didn't come to bring us a religion. He came that we might have life, that we might have it more abundantly. And I don't think religion was a big thing for Jesus. You're saying that there's a principle to which our Christianity points, and that is embodied in Christendom, that is actually the reality of the Christ, that is both the judging and redeeming dynamic of our life. And maybe we have to line up that way. I personally happen to think that the word religion is not one to be thrown out, but that there is one good sense in which it... I don't think religion is Christianity. I wouldn't want... Or religion and the Christ are the same. I wouldn't want to confuse those two things. But I do think that religion can still have a meaning, and that meaning is that power of being grasped by God's reality, God's holiness, God's power, God's meaning. That thing of which St. Paul says that all people are aware, that this is built into the very fabric of our creation, and that all people, I mean, I still don't think it's Christian, it's the reality of the Christ. That's something else again. But the awareness of God, if one calls that religion, I think that that's a good way to save the word. But it might be impossible in our own day. Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to ask a little bit about liberation theology and this Latin America and perhaps some in South Africa where you have Catholic guerrilla priests almost stashing guns from communist countries in their sacristies or whatever for, you know. And this is sort of goes back to my other question about whether communism and Christianity were mutually exclusive, and that is, do you think that there can be a communism in which Christianity can thrive, and or do you think that that maybe this is a mistake? You know, the churches, or not necessarily the churches, but individual members of churches cooperating so closely with Marxist factions when they're both involved in the overthrow of the same oppressive regime.
Well, of course, it is interesting that when Bonhoeffer sat in the prison camps, he sat next to the Marxists. And then it was the first time that he really realized that there were some Marxists around who were just passionately concerned for the poor. Then he did go into it more deeply, and he saw the roots of Marxism in the Judeo-Christian tradition. He saw Marxism as not as one of the non-historical religions that move about in a circle, or non-historical interpretations of history, like Greek thought, or Taoism, or Buddhism, or Hinduism, but as a movement along the historical line of history. He saw Marxism as having its prophets, who are actually in line with the Old Testament prophets. So, at least my response to this, and I would say perhaps the reason why many Latin American priests, or those in Southern Africa, let's say of our Evangelical Lutheran Ovambo Covambo Church, why are these people who are deacons of the church meeting with all these Eastern European communists all the time? Why is that? And they come from the pietistic tradition of the Finnish and the German missionaries. And these people are not, I would say, of the church, are not going to lose the dedication to the reality of Jesus Christ. They are personally committed. The depth of the spiritual life is, in my opinion, beyond question. Well, my simple answer is that there is a possibility of merging these two things together, but not on the basis of Orthodox Marxism.
That's right.
You cannot, on the basis of Orthodox Marxism, have anything to do with Christianity as we know it. But a new Marxism has developed. And there are Marxists around, except in sort of humorless places like East Germany, who think that, that you know, why this old Marx, this clanking materialism? Marxist, they say, is himself an ideology, talking about the classless society and putting everything into a frame of reference that allows no movement, no flexibility. So the Marxists today, and even if we're talking about Euro-communism, or if we're talking about Marxism in liberation theology in Latin America, is a horse of a different color. Our question is, what are the things that they've salvaged, and what are the things that they've dumped? And I think that's an answerable question. If you read, you see this historical movement. You see the passionate concern for the poor, for the exploited classes. Christianity and Marxism, now I'm talking about together. You see about that history is in the process of transformation, of change. There is a sense of looking towards fulfillment, although obviously a Christianity disavows any type of fulfillment within the historical order. Although partial fulfillment, we call it the kingdom of God. Little moments at which at time history goes through a change and peace and justice is established here and there, never fully, but partially. And they see that the allure of Marxism is perhaps, rather than Christianity, is precisely the fact that Christianity has lost its original roots to be that force that liberates the captives, that delivers from exile. Or as Jesus says, the Spirit is upon me, that the oppressed might be delivered, and you know how it goes. And the whole message of Jesus is lost. And so the interesting combination of Jesus and Marx today, that maybe we're fighting battles that we shouldn't even be fighting. We might be fighting the wrong battles as we enter into this. It's not enough to say, damn Marxist, and spit, and you know, and figure that that's the end of the matter. It's and we have to get with this task. I'm sorry, make it too long the remark.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say that I can understand why the communists would use any means they can, because, of course, the techniques they use are not important. There is no morality in the communism by their techniques. But one thing I think these countries have to be careful about doing is when they accept the means and the techniques of the communists insofar as handling the problems, then they take the risk of becoming like these people, too. Accepting some of their morals. In other words, if we do things in a non-Christian fashion, then we can become the enemy ourselves.
I guess my whole concern is that as Americans, we are sort of so anti-communized, so anti-Marxized or something like that, that every time we see the word Marxism someplace, then we just completely close our eyes, you know, cover our face with our hands, so we don't even have to look at the situation. And that's the only thing I think we ought to sort of recognize that there can be we can coexist, or not even coexist. We can just sort of exist with, or maybe that is coexist. But with Marxists, then we should not neglect them just because they're Marxists. Because ultimately, all Marx ever wrote about was the overthrow of a system which he saw as repressive. You know, so intolerable conditions that he just could not stand. And somewhere, maybe out of the goodness of his heart, which must have something to do with being Christian, he saw that there was a better way somewhere along the line without that authoritarian.
I guess I'm having a gut level reaction to that last comment about the communists not having any morality. That's a hard one. We've certainly seen evidences that would make us believe so, but just to affirm what Paula just said, that to continue to draw our lines against capitalist and, along the lines of capitalist and communist, and look only that far is to our own destruction. I know that there are instances in South America where Christian guerrillas are fighting for liberation of their people, and the people that they are fighting have been trained by the Americans. Now that puts it into a whole different camp. So, you know, it's not like we're the moral ones and they aren't. So, I just had to say that.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else now with a comment? Yes.
Well, one thing that I see here, we're talking about the economic factors involved and that there is a lot of similarity between Marxism and the capitalism as far as their methods and what have you. But the one thing that Marx, it seems to me, overlooks is the fact that he is planning strictly, you might say, now, and there's no provision for the hereafter, where Christians are hopefully going on and worried about the hereafter as well as now.
Yeah, right. And I think that what you're saying here I mean, even people who don't believe in the hereafter might have a hard time believing that within the historical order, all of the alienation and the ambiguities of history will be overcome. You know, this is Marxist ideology. You know, this is where, of course, Paul Tillich says, Lutheranism is a good antidote to the more utopian forms of Marxism, because Lutherans have such a sense of sin and guilt and what he calls the ontological depths of evil in life. And I agree with Tillich, because this whole idea of perfectibility within the historical process is something that seems to be totally unrealistic. And though Lutherans might sometimes just mire around too much in their own guilt and sin, nevertheless, I think excessive utopia is impossible on Lutheran grounds. And of course, you add the very important point that not only is Marxism missing the dimension of the transcendent here and now, but it is missing that hope that that the vicissitudes and ambiguities of history will be gathered up, not within the historical process, but outside the historical process, in eternal salvation. And I think that is the meaning of eternal salvation, and its meaning for us today is precisely to counter any type of ideology which assumes that utopia can be established here and now. You want to
do
something? No. I'm an economist.
She's asked that a couple of times, and I've never been able to give her a satisfactory answer. Maybe you should give us your concept.
Well, you said something the other day. Excuse me, I don't want to, you know, talk. Well, you almost gave me the impression that you thought that the kingdom of God was the realizable reality within this historical order. That is to say, granted, we're not talking about a spatial dualism, this world and another world, that the Bible is really based on a temporal thing, before and after, the old covenant, the new covenant, the old being, the new being, the old creation, the new creation, okay? It's going to be the creation of a new heaven and a new earth. But we assume as Christians that the power of the kingdom of God, which is revealed in part now in Jesus Christ, the power of the kingdom, the signs of the kingdom, the parables and the miracles, these are all the indications of the reality of the kingdom's power. And we live in that awareness that power is available. And that whenever there is healing among people, wherever there is healing in a society, that is God's power acting, and that we have to see it and identify it. But do you want to go beyond that and to say that within the historical order, all of the alienation is going to be overcome? I don't think we can say that. The symbol of the second coming is our way of guarding against utopia. I mean, the meaning of the second coming of Jesus Christ.
Well, it seems like we have some inconsistencies when we talk about kingdom of God. We say, you know, that the kingdom has come and that there are signs of it now and that it will be fulfilled, you know, in the fullness of time, whatever that means. I don't have an answer. I'm struggling to decide what maybe I can. But it seems like the communists kind of, in a secular sense, a Marxist, takes literally the possibility of working towards relationship among all people as being a real possibility. It seems like liberation theologians and South American Christians take that very, very seriously. That's what they feel they're engaged in, is being part of the work, partners with God in the coming of the kingdom, and working within history for a historical realization of that.
Yeah, well, I think that's okay, but you have to be very careful. Are we bringing in the kingdom now?
No, I said partners.
We're partners. Well, Luther talked of us being co-creators in history also. I mean, that might not give it its ultimate sanction, but I think it's the... Go ahead, Jim.
No, but I you know, defining sort of the kingdom that way. Then it's entirely, you see, then it's entirely possible, even with it in the very orthodox Marxian point of view, to have some, you know, have religion or have the kingdom. Because ultimately, what Marx said, that there would exist, you know, sort of beyond this, or in this third stage, or beyond the third stage of history, a classless society where you really don't need rules, you know, where there's really no private property, where people will very harmoniously and peacefully get along. You know, he didn't really say that, but people have interpreted that that's what he meant. Why couldn't a kingdom exist in that kind of society?
Now, who says that?
No, this you. Marx has been variously interpreted as saying that in the after the history, or this after this prehistory, after this second stage, okay, there evolves after the revolution. There evolves a classless society where people will just live very harmoniously, very peacefully. There will be no need for rules. There'll be no need for order, no need for private property. That will be.
Do we as Christians think that's possible here?
Well, I don't. That's. But
the lion is
going to
lie down with the lamb.
Why couldn't God really grasp us all? Not
the capitalist.
Why not?
But there's no reason why the kingdom of God couldn't exist in a society like that. The organized church would have a hard time existing in society, because then that would be a contradiction to that society.
Isn't that Mao in China? A classless society where everything operates just like a machine?
Well,
I don't think so. Not what Marx thought. Even very radical writers have said they thought that China was approaching this kind of utopian society. But
the difference between Marx and Mao on this point is that Mao said, well, Marx was wrong, that the fulfillment comes in the classless society. He said we must always need new dialectics, and the dialectic always goes on because there's always room for betterment.
Mao said that.
That's what Mao said. Yeah. That's what Marx would not say.
Marx would not say that. So that obviously, then, in Marxian terms, you have not reached that in China.
Would you think, thinking ahead, could not maybe capitalists, there be another manifesto put out by a capitalist along with socialistic ideas?
What do you call us, a group of bumpers for talking cover?
Could be. Anything's possible.
The simple way we were told?
Say that again.
What do you think that Jesus would do if he were sitting here? Would he call us a brood of vipers for tearing this apart like the Pharisees? Or would he say, accept my way of life? Do as I tell you.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of communists who ask if Lenin would be happy if he returned today. But we have to ask ourselves what Jesus would say.
Well,
I think you're absolutely right. And what would Jesus say as he's looked at our church and our...
He would say, believe on me.
Yeah.
I'm the way, the truth, and the life.
Yeah. And that's what we're wrestling with in this hour, though.
Yeah, but if Jesus were in Nicaragua right now, well, I guess Nicaragua is almost over. But if Jesus were in Nicaragua a month ago, would he be preaching in Managua to Somoza's camp, or would he be out with the Marxist guerrillas, you know?
I think the more important question is to eliminate the conditional. Jesus is in Nicaragua. What is he saying? Who is he with?
Okay.
Right. It's been a theologian.
Does he take sides?
I'm not so sure that I would.
Well, does Jesus take sides? Well, I hope. In one sense, he takes sides. I mean, there's certainly a bias in the New Testament for one side rather than another side.
But he does not.
Woe to you, Pharisees! I mean, that's a side.
What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, but he does not leave bereft to his presence of judgment with the other side either. I get a little uneasy about this.
Yes, but I mean, you wouldn't say that it's just sort of one neutral thing.
No,
everybody's
neutrality. We're not talking about presence.
Okay, but I wasn't implying that he would be on one side or the other. I was responding to the fact that it's not clear. You know, I was responding to the fact that she was saying, well, what would Jesus do? But that's the problem, you know. In terms of a political question like that, you can't say, oh, well, Jesus would do this.
Well, it's like the dialectic between the kingdom and the coming kingdom. Mm-hmm. We say until the day of Jesus Christ. We have our own way of saying what the communists say.
One other problem in here, too, you know, that like in Nicaragua, we say Marxist guerrillas. Sometimes it would be kind of nice to say, you know, you have Christian guerrillas fighting for the sake of Jesus Christ. That's the problem. Well, I mean, we give Marx a lot of credit.
We've been trying to say, with respect to the revolution in Southern Africa, that most of these people that the newspaper calls Marxist guerrillas were dying in Southern Angola are actually members of the Lutheran Church. They don't even have to be that, but I would say over 90% of those that the newspaper puts as Marxist guerrillas fighting in Southern Africa, whether in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, in Zambia, Botswana, Mozambique, Angola, Namibia, are members of the Christian family. And it's I consider it the most hideous euphemism that is perpetrated in our own day through the media that these people are called Marxist terrorists.
They may be Marxist, but not terrorists.
Well, they're only Marxists in a very qualitative sense, and most of them don't know a thing about Marxism, but they know something about Jesus Christ.